It's time for security now. Steve Gibson's here. Boy, there is a lot of security news. We have a topless Vladimir Putin. We have a really shocking flaw in the BIOS of many computers, including Lenovo's and Dell's. We'll talk about that. And Steve will answer, I think we get to one question, but it's a great question. And we'll talk about free BSD. So what could possibly go wrong? It's all ahead. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 568, recorded July 12th, 2016. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 237. Security Now is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com/securitynow and get $5 off your first order. And by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/securitynow. And by Adobe Marketing Cloud. Introducing audio white papers for marketing. White papers read aloud to keep you up to date with the latest trends and technologies. Listen today by searching Audio White Papers for Marketing on iTunes or visit adobe.com for more information. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security information and how to protect yourself and your privacy online with this guy right here, our explainer-in-chief, Steve Gibson from the Gibson Research Corporation. Hi, Steve.
I just have to comment that our listeners are going to hear the difference, and we need to explain.
Really? Is it that apparent?
It's remarkably remarkably more highs that I'm hearing.
Yeah.
And now maybe we'll lose those, you know, like in compression. Although, you know, I'm hearing a compressed result coming from Skype. So I don't know. But yeah, it's that we should tell people that you're beginning to move to the new facility and you've lost your curtains, which were clearly absorbing some of the high frequency.
So my studio office, which we're in right now, and the only shows we do here are the radio shows, Security Now, Windows Weekly. I think that's it. And so it's it doubles as my office, my office. And we built it when we built the studio 5 years ago with windows all the way around. So it's a fishbowl, and which is fine with me, except that I also like having some privacy. And because it's a studio, we wanted some sound dampening. So we got very thick, heavy red velvet drapes, which go all the way around, and they have been all the way around all this time. We're starting to take them. We took them down. And John, then after he took them down, said, uh-oh. I said, what? I said, you know, they really made a difference in terms of, you know, sound absorption in there.
The acoustics of that little room.
Because what you don't want in a studio is parallel reflective surfaces. Nothing's more
reflective
than glass. For
the sound to bounce
glass.
Back and forth.
Right. Right. Now, fortunately, this wall's got a bookshelf and hats on it, so there aren't any facing reflective surfaces, but it is much liver, I can tell. You know what it reminds me of? There's a sound processing device that was all the rage about 30 years ago called the Aphex Oral Exciter. Linda Ronstadt.
Now, that really could go.
I know. A-U-R-A-L.
Yes. Okay.
But the Aphex was used in a lot of albums. It was kind of the magic ingredient in some, you know, famous albums like some Linda Ronstadt albums and stuff. And I remember it was just really popular.
Was it a compander? Was that what they called those things?
Or they were... They still make it, actually. I'm looking at it right now. They call it an exciter.
An exciter. That's right. It's the oral exciter.
Yeah, so, which has an optical big bottom. And
if it has that many knobs on it, it must be good.
It's kind of a secret sauce. And but what I learned in those days was what it really does is some interesting phasing stuff. And you know what? Huh. I bet you anything that we are getting the effect of the Aphex Oral Exciter.
For free.
For free by eliminating the curtains. It's exactly that sound, which is a kind of a odd, almost a chorusing of the high end. And it pops.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're getting.
Well, we've now explained the audio and awakened all of our listeners. That's right. This is nominally a Q&A week, although, boy, is there a lot to talk about. Facebook Messenger gets end-to-end encryption. We got to talk about Russia's President Putin, the fate of Russian-based VPN endpoints,
boy.
Russian hackers compromising iOS devices, my promised follow-up on that Lenovo system management mode hack, which suddenly looked like it was going to be a lot more worrisome, and it is, the apparent illegality of password sharing, although this was kind of weirdly reported in the press, post-quantum crypto testing that started for the Google Chrome browser, reconsidering the value of antivirus add-ons. We have some Pokemon Go woes, a possible defense against crypto malware, news from the, of course someone had to try this department, miscellany, including the return tomorrow night, everyone, of Mr. Robot, Leo moving to FreeBSD.
Oh.
A recent PF Sense facelift. The Apollo assembly language source was the
awesome?
Most tweeted to me thing all week.
Yeah.
And even a little bit more. And if time permitting, we do have some questions from our fabulous listeners. So
you are an optimist.
We'll and I love the picture of the week only because Putin figures in the top three mentions. You know, and I was looking at him bareback. Wait, no.
There's a lot of pictures of him topless, I got to tell you.
But that's like a pony, isn't it? It's not a horse. If he was riding a horse, he would be like a little pawn.
You're actually right. He looks kind of big on it, doesn't he?
It's kind of a little Shetland or something.
Yeah, it might be an Arabian. They're kind of small. That is funny.
Probably fancy, whatever it is, but I think he's not as big as, you know, he wants to look on that horse.
If you Google topless Putin, you'll find many images of him.
No, actually, this was enough. I don't know how I found this one, but it's like, okay, of course, he made himself famous for taking his shirt off. Oh, my God, there it is, yes.
So I think it has something to do with his desire to be seen as a strong man and a hunky. And it may be something about the Russian culture. I don't understand it. But there are endless images of him topless.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't quite get
weird.
It. And there's the one.
And I think Chelsea Handler did a spoof on him, too. Of course, she was topless with a whole different sort of effect.
Easy to spoof, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, also our ever-changing North Korean leaders always seem to sort of be a little, you know, strange this way, like, you know, trying to create, you know, like having a marketing arm for themselves to create an impression in the mind of their populace.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. But yeah, lots of Russian news and good stuff to talk about this week.
Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. First, let's talk about I couldn't help but notice your extremely clean shave.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Watch out.
Watch out. He's got a chin that could cut butter. Of course, we're talking about Harry's. We love Harry's. In fact, it was all I could do to keep you from talking about Harry's when they didn't buy advertising on the show. Fortunately,
they're back.
They appreciated your love for Harry's so much they just said, we got to have ads on the Security Now show. Harry's makes high-quality, high-performance German blades. They're crafted by shaving experts. Of course, they've got all the features of the top-of-the-line, you know, grocery store or drugstore blades, the flex hinge that contours to your face. They've got an aloe lubricating strip. It's a great shave, and because Harry's owns the factory that makes these blades in Germany, of all places, they give you factory-direct pricing. That means instead of $4, you know, for a blade, $32 for an 8-pack in the drugstore, locked up behind plexiglass because it's so valuable, Harry's costs about half as much. And they come to your door, ship to your door, so you don't have to get in line. You don't have to get the druggist to unlock the display. A million guys have made the switch to Harry's. I'm so pleased about this. They've got a great website, and now they have an iOS app, too, which lets you place an order with them in just four clicks of the thumb. And it's a great customer service experience, too. Here's how it starts. Well, first of all, visit the Harry's page, harrys.com/security now. Then pick your kit. Steve's a fan of the Truman. Said, I'm a Winston kind of guy. I like the metal handle in the Winston. I love, you know, just it's engraved and it has a nice weight to it. But you got a Winston and you said, you know, I like the Truman better. It's a little less expensive, but I think you like the way it feels in your hand. And that they have a new soft touch rubberized exterior that's really nice. A variety of colors, too. Now, here's the best part. It's $15 to get started. And that doesn't just include the handle. It includes three blades, a blade cover for travel, and a full-size, not a trial sample, but a full-sized bottle of the foaming gel or the shave cream. Now, you do have to choose that. I'm a shave cream guy. I like the cream. It comes in a tube, and you kind of slather it on. And I just love how that feels. But a lot of people like the foaming gel, like the, you know, it's kind of like the fusion gel. If you like that, they have a really, really nice one. It smells great. Okay, so then you got the $15 kit. That comes to you. Then you sign up for a shave plan. And they ask you, well, how many times a day or a week do you shave? And then we'll give you blades and we'll give you more shave cream on a regular basis. It just comes to you. Don't forget they have other items, too, like that incredible face lotion with the SPF 15, which now that you're in the summertime, guys, you got to wear sunscreen. They got the daily face wash, the post-shave balm. This lotion, I wear sunscreen now every day because it's the single most important thing that not only preventing skin cancer but preventing aging. And this really is lightweight. It's not greasy. It goes on really easy. I just put it on in the morning. And it's SPF 15. It hydrates you. $8, and you can have that be part of, as I have, part of my regular shave plan. So here's the deal. Go to Harry's, harrys.com/security now. Get your $15 Truman kit, or if you want, a $25 Winston kit. You choose. Truman's probably a good way to start, but either kit will get you $5 off that first purchase by going to harrys.com/security now. Ooh, this is new. A limited. I might have to do this matte black. I have like 8 of these handles, you know, because I just. This is a gift. $40. You not only get the new matte black Winston, but you also get an engraved stand, which is really nice. Ooh, that's pretty. Ooh, great gift for dad or grad. Harrys.com/security. Now, and $5 off your first purchase.
Yeah, in my handles, I like to have a lack of axial symmetry.
I agree, because then you know which way's front.
Yes.
And you don't spend a whole morning shaving yourself with the back of the razor.
Yeah, because really,
doesn't do it anything.
Would take all morning.
All right.
So, Facebook Messenger. We talked about WhatsApp not long ago, a few months ago. Of course, we're always talking about WhatsApp because they're in trouble in Brazil all the time. But Facebook has moved the Signal protocol into Messenger. So they call it Secret Conversations. And it's not the default. It is something you can engage optionally on a per-conversation basis, which to me, I think that's exactly the right trade-off. Because as we know, the way they've implemented it, they're unable, because it is encrypted from end to end, things like their chatbot, which requires sniffing the conversation as it goes through Facebook servers, that all gets excluded when you have end-to-end encryption. So there will be some loss of extra fancy functionality that goes along with turning secret conversations on. They used the now available open source Signal protocol libraries. There's one for Java and also one for C. They make a point that that they have an entirely different back-end structure. They use a different transport protocol, a specialized on-device storage, and separate back-end infrastructure. Next week, I'm going to go into more in-depth into two other features. One they call abuse reporting, and the other is this implementation of secure storage. Because as I began to look at it, it was like, okay, this is too big for a bullet point. So, and looks interesting. Looks like there actually is maybe some new technology there that I want to talk about. Of course, because, you know, Messenger is a major messaging platform for the internet, given that it's, you know, the default in Facebook. So they have a white paper, 11 pages, that is available. And mostly it is sort of a reprinting of the Signal protocol. And of course, Signal, as we know, Moxie and his team absolutely did it right at Open Whisper Systems. This is it's when I as our listeners will remember, when I first started looking at it, I was thinking, whoa, is this thing over-engineered and over-complicated? Because, I mean, you just have stuff going in every direction at once and ratcheting protocols and key exchanges. And a lot of it seemed like overkill. But when you look, and as we did when we covered this in detail a few months back, there's a reason for it. And you get all kinds of extra neat things. Like, for example, and you have a non-real-time messaging protocol. That's where, for example, OTP falls, because that has to be real-time end-to-end. With Signal, they solve the problem of sending a message to somebody who isn't available at that instant in order to have a real-time interchange with. So, and a lot of the extra machinery in the Signal protocol supports that, I would argue, very valuable feature. As it's the kind of thing where somebody, if they turned on secret conversations and it suddenly broke the way they're used to using Messenger, which is asynchronously, then that would seem like wrong to them. It's like, wait, I want to have a secret conversation, not a broken conversation. So anyway, bravo to Facebook. And of course, this ups the ante yet again on this whole controversy we're steeped in at the moment, like this whole question of encryption on the internet, which takes us to Putin, whether his shirt is on or off. I'm sure it was on during his press conference last Thursday. He ordered, 5 days ago, the Federal Security Service Bureau, the FSB, which, as I understand it, that's the renamed KGB, right? So that's like the Russian security people. He ordered them to produce encryption keys, is the way it's phrased, capable of decrypting all data on the internet. Okay. But no one's really sure exactly what that means, because, of course, it's impossible. The FSB can't just suddenly do that. So this was part of a new plan that the Russian government is implementing effective July 20th. So this is where they have 2 weeks to do this. And it's signed under law under the anti-terrorist bill. So, for example, some highlights from this are that telecom providers and this is broadly defined, unfortunately, quote, organizers of information distribution. So that is everyone assumes that means websites, because websites are organizers of information distribution. Get this: must store copies of the content of all information they transmit, including phone calls and text messages, for 6 months, and store the metadata for 3 years, so that they can give the Kremlin whatever it wants, whenever it wants it. Now, and this is not just, you know, they're not storing it in encrypted form. It has to be in plain text form somehow. And then secondly, not only do organizers of information distribution, unquote, have to store all transmitted information, they have to turn over, quote, any information necessary to decrypt those messages. And so that so additional coding, as it says in the law, must be added to electronic messages, which will function as instructions for the FSB to decode them. So, you know, reading between the lines, this sounds like someone who was a politico who doesn't understand crypto at all, doesn't want to use the word backdoor, but absolutely wants the equivalent, is saying that, you know, I mean, this quote, this additional coding is code for, you know, a second key or something.
It sounds so much like Feinstein-Burr, which said, we're not going to tell you to do a backdoor. You just have to be able to give us the information, exactly. Whatever that takes.
Exactly. So in pronouncing Mr. Putin's decision to sign the amendments into law Thursday, his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, told reporters that the president instructed the government to make adjustments if the measures indeed do pose any, quote, financial risks, unquote. But there again, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? Dmitry, quote, the government will keep a close eye on how this law is implemented, and if some unpleasant consequences are discovered, the president will ask the government to take steps. Again, Merck added to more Merck. So, again, you know, it's like I'm glad I'm in the United States of America. Although, as you said, Leo, Feinstein-Burr was trying to do the same
thing.
Not
so very different, yeah. I think every government. But the real problem is this means, well, they're going to have to outlaw WhatsApp. They're going to have to outlaw Facebook. They're going to have to, because no backdoor is possible.
Yes. And that's what's, when I say this is going to be really interesting, it's the reporting now downstream of this, what's going to happen. Now, what has already happened, several of our listeners who were users of a VPN service called Private Internet Access sent me snapshots of a message that they received on their devices yesterday saying, we are removing our Russian presence. And so this letter reads, to our beloved users, the Russian government has passed a new law that mandates that every provider must log all Russian internet traffic for up to 1 year. We believe that due to the enforcement regime surrounding this new law, some of our Russian servers were recently seized by Russian authorities without notice or any type of due process. We think it's because we are the most outspoken and only verified no-log VPN provider. Now, okay, we can see that they're spinning this into a little bit of a PR bump for themselves. But still, they continue. Luckily, since we do not log any traffic or session data, period, no data has been compromised. Our users are and will always be private and secure. Upon learning of the above, we immediately discontinued our Russian gateways and will no longer be doing business in that region. To make it clear, the privacy and security of our users is our number one priority. For preventative reasons, we are rotating all of our certificates. And of course, if Russians or some aspect of the Russian government seized their servers, then they obtained what you want to protect most in your server, which is the private key, which, you know, so that only the public key is exposed, the private key is explicitly kept secret. But if Russian authorities come and raid your data center and take your servers, you've lost control of your keys. So they absolutely had to immediately cease all use of keys that could have been compromised. So they said, we're rotating all of our certificates. Furthermore, we're updating our client applications with improved security measures to mitigate circumstances like this in the future, on top of what's already in place. In addition, our manual configurations, and then they go on with more marketing spiel. But so the point is, here is the first of, as you were saying, Leo, many probable pullouts from the Russian Federation, because it may come down to essentially what Brazil has been trying to do with WhatsApp, which is either give us the content of conversations or we're going to shut you down. And in this case, it's if you do encrypted communications that we cannot decrypt, you are breaking Russian law. And so the consequence is pull out. Yeah. I know, because I mean, now
that would be the economic consequence, I would think, that they're referring to, is like, if this puts, you know, makes us a third world nation, maybe we won't do it.
Exactly. And so what, again, so I'm glad I'm not there, of course. Oh, and Snowden's not happy. He, you know, he grumbled about it.
It's a dark day for Russia.
Exactly.
He forgot that he was living in a totalitarian state, apparently.
They were the only one that would have him.
Yeah.
So anyway, fascinating to see what's going to happen. And I mean, so here we have real, like, the immovable forces coming into collision. Putin saying no encryption, that FSB cannot decrypt. So what happens? Do the services remain but go decrypted? I mean, you can't do usernames and passwords. I mean, even if we rolled back 10 years to when most things were HTTP, but at least logging in was secure. Now, of course, we know that was never actually even secure, because the browser was given a cookie, which, if that cookie is not marked as secure, and it can't be marked as secure, if you're then going to fall back and maintain session state over an HTTP non-encrypted connection, we know, that allows session hijacking, you know, a la FireSheep, trivially. So, do services drop crypto and remain, or do they they think, oh, wait, we can't do that because then we're going to confuse people. Are we encrypted or not? You know, where do we get encrypted? Really, really fascinating to see what happens when, you know, a strong man says, no internet encryption that we can't.
Russia's not such a big market that these companies couldn't walk away. Now, if China does it, that would be interesting.
And this may, you know, China may be watching too. Right. It's like, let's see how this goes. What do companies do? I think you're right, Leo. I think companies have to pull up stakes. They have to say, okay, fine. And what does that turn Russia into, you know, on the internet? Imagine then all of the valuable services that they have now that they've gotten accustomed to using that will go away. I mean, you know, here we've got one VPN provider saying, okay, see ya. And it has to be everybody else.
Right.
Yeah. So, wow.
Really interesting.
Interesting next few weeks.
Yeah.
There was also some weird things going on with iOS devices. People stating that their iOS devices were becoming locked in so-called lost mode, and with a Russian extortion demand appearing on the screen. So, and those who have dug into it believe that what's going on is that this may be another downstream consequence of these recent mega breaches that we've talked about. The LinkedIn, for example, you know, breach that caught Mark Zuckerberg when he wasn't paying attention to his Twitter account, where through password reuse and then probably some phishing attacks in order to get people's Apple IDs, if you have the Apple ID and matching password, then you can put a device into lost mode where it essentially locks it up, displays a message on the screen. Now, typically, this is, you know, you left your phone at the airport, so you want to tell whomever finds it Hi there. This is my phone. You can't use it because I've locked it now. But, you know, here's how to find me and I'd like to get it back and so forth. So, and I've never messed with this myself, but as I understand it, it can make a sound. You can tell it you want the sound to make noises.
Right.
So that it gets seen or found and display a message. So there, these people, these scammers are asking anywhere between $30 and $50. And so some people are paying. Some people, and apparently there's like Google has been finding people typing this weird Russian extortion in and asking for translations because it's like, okay, my phone is speaking Russian and I don't know what it says. And I guess that's a problem if it's, you know, just gibberish. But and then, of course, other people are just doing a factory reset because as long as you have a backup or as recent as your backup is, a factory reset and a restore from the most recent backup will recover from lost mode. But there isn't anything else that anyone can do. You can't unlose it, as I understand it. That is, if a third party has maliciously put it into lost mode, all you can do is, you know, redo a full factory reset and restore.
Kind of weird because and
it's not massive, it's not widespread.
Yeah, I wonder how they're doing that, it's
people. Yeah, it, and again, they have to have both the user ID and password. Yeah. So that's where the presumption has come
somehow. Right,
right. Or phished you, you know, fished it may have been you, right. like a fake message from Apple. It's like, oh, it's time for you to reassert your identity. Please enter your Apple ID and password. And, you know, a lot of people will.
I was, for a while, Henry had lost his phone, so it was very credible to me. For a while, I was getting text messages saying, this is Apple, and we found your lost phone. Click this link, which, of course, is a phishing link to your account, and claim it. You know, we have it. Or we know where it is, but you have to log in, obviously, to prove that you're you. And it was very credible because the timing was right when Henry lost his phone. That was just, I think, coincidental.
Yes. Well, and remember, I think we talked about it on this podcast. Years ago, there was that weird scam where a friend who was traveling abroad would apparently send email saying that they got in trouble and they need help.
That was a Yahoo Mail hack. Yeah.
Right. And it was so believable that a lot of money got transferred.
So silly. I hope people are getting just like really skeptical now. You know.
Well, and we'll be talking about this and Pokemon Go here in a minute because that's caused the
I'm not going to stop playing this game. I don't care what you say.
Okay, just be careful about the cameras that you buy on sale from China during Amazon Prime Day because
that's another thing. Yeah,
yeah. So Lenovo, this is not good. So what exists in many ThinkPads? Some Yoda, is it Yoda or Yoga?
Yoga.
Yoga, yeah, I thought so. Some.
Though I would buy a Yoda laptop.
Also, some other devices, and I put a link in the show notes because there is an extensive list of like, I mean, it just scrolls and scrolls with every single model. And for example, even my brand new Carbon 4th generation X1 vulnerable.
No, and it's a BIOS vulnerability.
Well, it's worse, actually.
Oy, they say system management mode, right?
Right. It's an SMM, system management mode vulnerability. So here's what it means. From a malicious app running locally, so it's only local, but the app has to have admin privilege. So if something is running on that machine and obtains or is given admin privilege, this bug allows the write protection to be removed from the firmware, safe boot mode to be bypassed, and the firmware to be altered to install a permanent malicious pre-boot rootkit. So... and okay, so I got a kick out of Lenovo. Lenovo's... disclosure is a little bit butt covering, but okay. So because they're not happy about how this came down, they said their support article, execution of code in SMM by an attacker with local administrative access. They say Lenovo's product security incident response team is fully aware of the uncoordinated disclosure, is the way they put it, by an independent researcher of a BIOS vulnerability located in the system management mode code that impacts certain Lenovo PC devices. Shortly after, the researcher stated over social media that he would disclose a BIOS-level vulnerability in Lenovo products. Lenovo PCERT, which is their product security incident response team, made several unsuccessful attempts to collaborate with the researcher in advance of his publication of this information. Since that time, so we can all read between the lines, since that time, Lenovo has actively undertaken its own investigation, which remains ongoing. At this point, Lenovo knows that vulnerable SMM code was provided to Lenovo by at least one of our independent BIOS vendors. So we have a new acronym, the IBV, the Independent BIOS Vendor. Independent BIOS vendors, IBVs, are software development firms that specialize in developing the customized BIOS firmware that is loaded into the PCs of original equipment manufacturers, including Lenovo, but not only. We'll get to that in a second. Following industry standard practice, IBVs start with the common code base created by chip vendors such as Intel or AMD, and in this case, Intel. It's the Series 8 reference code, and add additional layers of code that are specially designed to work with a particular computer. Lenovo currently works with the industry's three largest IBVs. The package of code with the SMM vulnerability was developed on top of a common code base provided to the IBV by Intel. Importantly, because Lenovo did not develop the vulnerable SMM code and is still in the process of determining the identity of the original author, it does not know its originally intended purpose. It's like, what? Okay. But as part of the ongoing investigation, Lenovo is engaging all of its IBVs as well as Intel, to identify or rule out any additional instances of the vulnerabilities present in the BIOS provided to Lenovo by other IBVs, as well as the original purpose of the vulnerable code. So
again, how many IBVs are there? I mean, there's Phoenix.
Yeah, those are the guys. And so they talked about.
I don't think there are that many. There are three.
So,
all right.
Yeah, and remember the an award, but there's also been some acquisitions.
AMI.
Yeah, so there has been some coalescing in that industry, but it's like probably the three are the three. I mean, and there may be some, you know, some small guys, for example, that specialize in BIOS code for specific like low volume subassembly stuff that not everyone's putting in all these. Okay, so the guys posting. It's beautiful reverse engineering. I mean, it's and unfortunately, as Lenovo grumbles, this was not done in the modern model of full of responsible disclosure. This guy wanted the glory of just putting it out there, and unfortunately, until firmware updates are available, a huge number of laptops are vulnerable to this. He's got proof of concept exploit code, instructions for compiling it, including Visual Studio project files to make the whole thing just, you know, script kiddie compatible. So there's a little bit of chronology in his posting on the on July 2nd, he wrote, he added that one of his followers confirmed that vulnerable code is present in his HP Pavilion laptop. Alex James found vulnerable code on motherboards from Gigabyte. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 different model numbers listed. And they're Z68, Z77, 87, and 97 family motherboards. That was on the 5th. On the 6th, a Japanese researcher found vulnerable code in Fujitsu Lifebooks and other Fujitsu computers, probably affected. We don't know that for sure, but certainly that one particular Lifebook model. And Dell Latitude, the E6430, is also vulnerable. So what's happened here is that unfortunately, it looks like this. It's not clear that it came from Intel or that it was added by the IBV, but what happened is there's sort of relatively universal BIOS firmware, which either Intel or the IBVs are supplying, which across the industry contain this vulnerability, which essentially was released as a zero day. I mean, just bang, here it is, have fun.
How do you make it happen, though? I mean, do you have to have physical access?
Yes. So it's a local vulnerability,
right, so
something
it's not so bad.
Malicious. Yes, correct. Something running locally on your laptop with admin privileges can then essentially install itself. So you have to have malware first. It has to be malicious, and it's able to install itself into the BIOS in a way that you would never be able to remove it.
So any virus could do this.
Yes.
As long as it can get administrative access.
Right. And, of course, there's lots of ways to get that these days. Right. That doesn't seem to slow things down very much.
Well, that's pretty nasty.
So there, it turns out, looking at mitigations, they had a mitigation section. And I was on, oh, great. Something I can tell our listeners. It's like, don't run with admin and don't turn your laptop on. And it's like, okay, well. The good news is the industry is scrambling to figure this out. I mean, that's the only good side of there being a high window of criticality is that it's got everybody's high power, attention to immediately patch this rather than, the stories we've heard of people waiting, 9 months for a response from the vendor and then finally saying, okay, fine. Just be careful. Everybody,
be careful out there.
The good news is they know what the vulnerability is. The flip side of the full disclosure is that it provides full documentation for fixing it also. So there's no excuse for this taking long. So, and unfortunately, what we've got HP, we've got Fujitsu, we've got Dell. It looks like it's across the industry. So think in terms of a firmware update coming to your machine soon.
The problem is that they don't come to your machine. You have to seek them out.
Yes. 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 And the other problem is, like, for example, if you're a Lenovo user and you're smart, you've turned off all of that horrible crapware that they add to do things like go check to see if there's new firmware, because that's worse than the firmware problem.
Right.
So anyway, that's why last week I said, okay, this thing exploded. So I need to understand what it is. That's what it is. It is, it's worth checking. And now I've only been talking about ThinkPads, but it's Lenovo computers, and I don't know, and there's a laptop. Maybe it's only laptop chipsets, but don't take my word for it. These all look like Lifebook.
They make servers,
and
too.
6430. Yeah, and Lenovo does have on that page on that is linked here a complete list. A lot of it is some they know are not vulnerable, And it's funny too, because it, for the first several pages of this, as I was scrolling down, it was either not vulnerable or we're still checking. And I'm thinking, is that what you're going to say for all of the problems? Still checking? But I got way down.
They say more researching.
That's what it was, right?
Researching.
It's like, okay. But way down when I got into the ThinkPad section, which is down deeper, most of the ThinkPads are vulnerable. And all the ones I have are. I mean, even the old X, the X430 and the 220, the brand new X1 Carbon. So it's like, yeah, it'll be nice to flash some firmware. Haven't
terrible,
done that for a
while. Terrible. This is really bad.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah, well, because it is, I mean, it's the worst nightmare. It potentially installs a hidden rootkit backdoory thing.
You'll never know. You'll never know. And you can't eradicate.
Right. You can't format away.
Oh,
yep.
My God. That's as bad. I guess this is as bad as you can get.
Yeah, it would be a little. The only thing worse would be if it were in the thing that's now monitoring our network interface adapters all the time, and you could do it remotely. Right. Then it would just be okay. You know, Code Red, NIMDA, MS Blast, right. Game over.
The mitigation is disconnect.
The mitigation is maybe look, keep checking for firmware update news from your various vendors. So the press had a field day with this, and it's like, okay, it's a little overheated. Although we did hear some sanity from our friend Judge Reinhart with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He's done. We've talked about him in the past in a favorable light, as I recall. So this is a 2012 trial where the plaintiff was found guilty. And of course, again, in sort of clickbait mode, what we were seeing in the headlines was share your password, go to jail. And it's like, what? Okay, so here's the whole story. A recent federal court ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is ours out here on the West Coast, could make sharing your passwords for subscription services. Now, this is the sort of the extension, and this is what Reinhart was concerned about. But sort of the lead into this says that sharing your passwords for subscription services covering everything from Netflix to HBO Go, a federal crime punishable by prison time.
Oh, yeah.
wrote a judge who opposed the decision. And I quote him in a second. The ruling pertained to a trade secrets case found that certain instances of sharing passwords are prosecutable under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, predominantly concerned with hacking. The case involved David Nossel, a headhunter who left his former company, Korn Ferry, and later used the password provided to him by a still-employed assistant to access the company's database and use that information for competitive purposes at his new competing firm. According to Fusion, defendant was convicted of hacking charges in 2013, the case began in 2012, and sentenced to 1 year and a day in prison. The appeals court upheld, so here's the, this is the news, is that just recently, the appeals court upheld the conviction 2-1. So it wasn't unanimous. One of the two judges upholding the lower court decision, Margaret McCohen, wrote, this access, so she's the one who was for upholding the guilty verdict, says this access falls squarely within the CFAA's, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, prohibition on access without authorization, unquote. And thus, we affirm the conviction for violations under the CFAA. However, in his minority dissenting opinion, Judge Stephen Reinhart argued that the case was not about hacking, but password sharing. Consequently, he argued, the ruling jeopardizes password sharing for the general public. He wrote, the ruling loses sight of the anti-hacking purpose of the CFAA, and despite our warning, threatens to criminalize all sorts of innocuous conduct engaged in daily by ordinary citizens. The majority that is making this decision does not provide, nor do I see, writes Reinhardt, a workable line which separates the consensual password sharing in this case from the consensual password sharing of millions of legitimate account holders, which may also be contrary to the policies of system owners. There simply is no limiting principle in the majority's world of lawful and unlawful password sharing. So the concern, if Reinhardt is right, it could place users of popular streaming sites like HBO Go and Netflix, who share their passwords, in breach of the CFAA and open to federal prosecution. So now I think it's clear that there was badness done in this case where the appellate court said, this is really wrong. An assistant still employed gave someone she knew was no longer employed the password to, which may well have been changed since this guy left. I mean, it had to have been, otherwise he could have used it, in order to remotely gain entry to their privileged confidential data and database. You know, that seems clearly hacking. But also there seems to be plenty of guilt here to be spread around, because I would argue that, you know, her employer certainly has grounds for being upset with her as well. I mean, if she still has a job there. I don't know any of that background. But anyway, so what the press has done, and you'll see this in the headlines, is, oh my God, you know, now sharing your
That's
password.
That's quite a jump. I mean.
Yes, exactly.
Could is the operative, you know.
Right. But Reinhardt's position is, well, you know, this provides post-appellate case law to affirm this concept of sharing a password is a crime under the CFAA. And as he said, there's no way to draw a line. There's no clear delineation that the law would like to somehow make between somebody sharing their Netflix password. I mean, that's against the law. The license agreement says you can't.
But I don't think that the judges have quite a bit of leeway. They don't have to do, just because it could be applied in that case, doesn't mean they have to do that. There's a lot of stuff that is technically illegal, but that a court would say, well, come on, that's de minimis.
Well, and the whole question too is, what will the punishment be? Because if it's, you know, it could just be a slap on the hand, or you know, we're going to make you watch, you know, reruns of something horrible for the rest of your life. So, interesting piece of news. A lot of our listeners sent it to me because they thought this would be interesting to talk about on the podcast. And that is that in some Chrome browsers, and because it's experimental and it's not widely distributed yet, there's something called Chrome Canary.
Canary is the beta. So right. Actually, the gamma. So there's a... or alpha, I guess it would be. So what's even more cutting edge than beta? Alpha, right?
Right.
It's the alpha. Because there's Canary developer, and then there's, I mean, Chrome developer, then Chrome Canary. But you can install it. I mean, it's on the...
Yeah. So, and users who do can dig down into some configuration dialog somewhere and see whether this is present in their Canary build and turn it on or off. Google is experimenting with what they're calling post-quantum crypto. And certainly a topic that never really leaves my Twitter feed is, oh my God, you know, quantum computers are coming. crypto will is going to all just melt down. And I actually, in the paper that is written, or maybe it was on the website, this has a website, CECPQ1.com. I'm not sure what the first C is for, but the EC is elliptic curve, and then the PQ1 is post-quantum. So what they've done is they've merged elliptic curve, which, and actually they're using my favorite Bernstein 255519 curve, which was the genesis of Squirrel. It's because of the properties of this amazing elliptic curve that's what made Squirrel possible. And when it suddenly, you know, clicked in my brain, they're connecting that with something called New Hope Key Agreement, which always makes me think of a Star Wars episode for some reason. So that's this thing. Anyway, on the site, they talk about, they refer to this as quantum nervousness, which is the general sort of background nervousness over, okay, yes, classic computing architectures are growing at a rate that we've been tracking for two decades now, and we have a sense for it. And so, you know, we know that SHA 128 is kind of okay, MD5 not, SHA 256, that gives us lots of security margin, and we're ready to go bigger as we need to, sort of, you know, scaling the existing crypto technology with processing power. But then, of course, we've got this, the coming out of left field is the specter of a computer that works in an entirely different way, the so-called quantum computing, which, if everything works the way they say it would in such a computer, it completely short circuits the fundamental nature of one type of crypto. And this is worth pointing out. It's only the public key crypto that is in danger. This quantum cryptography does not endanger private key, that is secret key or symmetric key crypto. So like the AES 256, the quantum computing has nothing to say about that. And again, that's also easily scalable, but no one expects that to collapse. It's the so-called one-way functions, which inherently exist in the public key crypto, which is a concern. That is, we know, for example, we've talked about it through the years, it's very easy to raise a number to raise an integer to an integer power in a modulus field, that is a so-called finite field. That's trivial, but that we know of no way to, in a reasonable time, reverse that operation. That is, to get a discrete logarithm of that, the reverse of exponentiation. Similarly, we can multiply two really big primes trivially, but given that product, we have still discovered, despite lots of work, no good way to examine that what we know is a product of two primes and discern what those two primes are. So again, multiply easy, factoring hard. Exponentiation easy, discrete logarithm hard. It's the asymmetric crypto, these one-way functions, that's where the nervousness comes from. The idea that if you had a sufficiently capable quantum computer that, as far as we know, doesn't even begin to exist with the level of complexity that it needs. Because quantum computers, the size of problem they can handle is a function of their complexity. And what's spooky about them is that they change this whole concept from brute force to like checking all possible solutions at once, as unnerving as that sounds. Anyway, so being on the leading edge, there already is a proposed spec for a key agreement protocol. That is the what, again, once we have the symmetric key, we're not worried about any kind of computing, quantum or not. It's the problem that some a huge leap forward in computing technology might kill asymmetric crypto. And so it turns out there is a different way of operating, a different kind of one-way function involving lattices. And I've not looked into it at all, but they've named it the New Hope. Probably actually is after Star Wars. So what this does is this concatenates two different technologies, and a paper exists, code exists, and it's actually running in Canary browsers. And again, no one needs it, but this is Google. This is one of the advantages Google has, having a widely distributed browser of their own. They can experiment with things, for example, as they have in the past, like the HTTP 2.0 spec, where they're experimenting with compression and header compression and tweakings of the protocols. They're able to bring it up on their servers and then to, you know, optionally move it out into the browsers and then instrument this and see how it performs in the real world. One of the problems with this technology until very recently was performance, because it was agonizingly slower than what we have today. And this technology, this New Hope key agreement approach, says maybe about 1.6 times slower. So in a world where you actually do have quantum computing, fine, I'll take it, because we really do need the technology of public key agreement to remain standing. And so the good news is Google's playing with it, and I imagine that by the time we need it, we'll have it. There was an interesting article, and it was the fact that it was in Yahoo News that sort of came to my attention, because it's just, you know, that's sort of a more pop lay news outlet. And this article in Yahoo News was supporting the idea that antivirus software is becoming increasingly useless and may make your computer less safe. Now, it was a series of interviews of security people following from the rather catastrophic Symantec kernel flaw that we talked about last week, where virtually the entire Symantec product line was found to have a bad vulnerability because it was filtering internet traffic in the kernel. It was remotely exploitable by something that, by just like sending a message, no user had to take any action, because the act of this flowing through the connection could allow a system compromise. So this sort of, you know, that's an instance of what we've also, sort of the broader topic of the general attack surface problem, which is the more stuff you add, and of course Lenovo is infamous for this, the more stuff you add, the more opportunities there are for something to break, because as we know, security is hard. So anyway, that was just sort of the gist of this story. There were among the quotes there from various security experts that the author of the story quoted, someone said, yeah, the antivirus software used to be 80 to 90% effective, but now it was really about 10% effective, mostly because the nature, and Leo, I've heard you talking about this a lot on the Tech Guy show, the nature of the problem has changed. We have polymorphic viruses. The viruses are not static. They're staying ahead of the virus signature updates. But also, and you guys were talking about this on MacBreak Weekly, I think Renee was talking about the fact that the human factor is now become the weakest link in the chain, the so-called phishing problem, the, you know, just get somebody to click on this link somewhere within Sony and you can establish a foothold and hide yourself and then go from there. And I did hear somebody, one of our listeners, saying that he'd spent some time at his father's recently and, you know, removed whatever they, you know, AV they had and just installed the Microsoft package. And it's like, okay, fine, you know, pops, this is all you need.
Yeah.
Pokemon Go.
By the way, they fixed this issue in the iOS anyway.
So, and I added home to the end. Pokemon Go Home.
Oh, come on. You're just a cranky person.
I am.
You never leave your house. It wouldn't be any use. Actually, you go to the Starbucks.
Well, actually, yesterday at lunch was the first time I saw this in action. And I guess
there
was
a few people doing it, right?
Oh, well, so the place I eat is out on a nice patio with sort of a center court. And there's a Verizon cellular right next door, which is really handy because they've got really good Wi-Fi and no password. So I'm able to use the Wi-Fi while I'm there. Times out after two hours, but normally I'm not there for and needing to refresh. Anyway, so I'm watching this Verizon guy in his Verizon shirt with his Verizon logo, and he's holding his phone up high. And that seems to be somehow the sign of Pokemon.
Yeah, and swiping up with it. Yeah.
And so it's like up in front of his face, and he's completely transfixed and walks right into a tree.
Oh, no.
And so I thought, yep. And then I was talking to my server who takes care of me every early afternoon or late morning. And I was telling her about what was going on, and she came out like an hour later, and she says, okay, I hate this, whatever this is, this Pokemon thing. She says, everyone in the restaurant is doing it. And in fact, I saw there was a party of eight that they were like shuffling along very slowly. Every single one of them had their phone up, and they were like, completely transfixed by this and like sort of, but so they weren't moving at a regular pace. And then when they got to the front door, that nobody wanted to be the one who like arranged the table and everything, because that some creature might
busy.
Run by.
Yes,
I don't know
busy.
What was going on. Oh my Lord. But there was in the news a concern, which was that, And I guess this is what you're saying they fixed. And is that the Google app permissions?
Yeah, that's right.
Got fixed? Good.
They say they did that by it was an error, and they fixed it as soon as they found out about it.
So for our listeners who don't know, the early installs, Pokemon, was it only Android or Android and iOS?
Android and iOS.
Would ask for full permissions at Google. So that is this week's Bitly link, that is to say the Google security permissions page. So you can get to it with bit.ly/sn-568. And so the point is, we've talked about this from time to time, these sorts of things, whether it's Twitter permissions or Facebook app permissions or Google, it's nice to just sort of audit them. And really nothing brings that to mind, unless, you know, something brings it to mind. So now just think about it. I looked at mine, and sure enough, there were a number of apps that I no longer use, yet they still had permissions. And interestingly, only Chrome had full permissions into Google. Every other one of maybe like 10 had much more modest permissions. So that sort of demonstrates that the original Pokemon probably didn't need full permissions. It was just, as they said, oops, sorry, we didn't mean to be so aggressive. But again, bit.ly/sn-568, just, you know, check in. Again, this is attack surface minimization, remove the things you no longer need. There's no reason to have them sitting around. They just represent an opportunity for exploitation.
And while you're doing it, I mean, really what these are is the Google Connect, Facebook does it too, and Twitter does it. And you'll see these all over the web where it's a quick login. It says you can create an account or you can log in with your Google account or your Facebook account or Twitter account. And all three of those networks will have a page where you can go and see where you've done that, which apps you've connected. And it's a absolute must kind of quarterly thing to go through those and delete the old apps because they still have permissions until you revoke them.
Right.
And in this case, yeah, they say it was an error. It's typical for your browser to ask for that kind of access because that way they can access Gmail without asking for additional logins, things like that.
Right.
I look at mine and it's all either a browser or an operating system that has that kind of permissions.
Well, and if you're not trusting Google's Chrome browser to have access to Google,
right.
then, you know, right. just go use Firefox.
Right. So the Pokemon Go used that quick login. You didn't have to use it. They also allowed you to use to create an account at the Pokemon Trainer site. But it did give you that. And normally what you'll do is you'll get a list of the requested permissions and you can say allow or deny. In this case, it didn't give you that list. It just gave that Pokemon Go full access to everything. So if you update your Pokemon Go, and I guess what you'll need to do is remove access, it'll ask you to log in again and then it will ask for those more limited permissions. It's pretty typical for games to, for instance, here's a game that says, I just want access to Google Play to verify your account. That
right.
kind of stuff. That's much more typical.
Right. And much more well-behaved.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Pokemon Go is going to send email on my behalf, but it's just, you know, good
stuff. So a listener of ours who left himself anonymous, and the subject line caught my eye. It said his subject was Pokemon Go app spreads DroidJack malware. And he said, so he wrote to me, a bunch of news sites can be found talking about the subject simply by Googling. I believe I've been a victim. After realizing that I was infected, I factory reset my phone. However, it seems that DroidJack remains in place after a factory reset. He says, with an asterisk next to the item. Why? And he said, this is poor judgment on my part, installing an app from a third party. I should have known better. I hope this will help anyone who listens to Security Now in the future. So a couple points. DroidJack is a malicious rat. We've talked about rats before, remote access Trojan. Well known, and it's been talked about, you know, Symantec and Kaspersky and others have described it. It was this infected version of Pokemon Go was uploaded to a malicious file repository. That is a file repository. I don't know if the whole thing was malicious, but it was malicious at 9:19 UTC on July 7th. So, you know, shortly after Pokemon was released, less than 72 hours after the game was officially released in New Zealand and Australia. So probably because the game had not yet been officially released globally, many people wishing to access the game before it was released in their region resorted to downloading the APK, the you know, the app file, from third parties. Many, and get this, Leo, many large media outlets provided instructions on how to download the game from third-party sites. Some even went further, providing instructions and encouragement for installing the APK download from a third party, quoting one of them, to install an APK directly, you'll first have to tell your Android device to accept side-loaded apps. This can usually be done by visiting settings, clicking into the security area, and then enabling the unknown sources checkbox. And, you know, the idea of that being said on some random, you know, news program somewhere, you know, oh, if Pokemon's not available in your area, here's how you can get it from a third party site. It's like, no. I mean, we were just the other day talking about making sure. I said that I had had to do that briefly to grab a copy of the Zio app or the Zio Companion before it was up on Google Play. But, you know, I knew who made it and who compiled it and understood the risks and turned that back off. And didn't you say, Leo, that there's something about it snapping back off, or am I confusing two different things?
Yeah, it does. So, but that's if you go somewhere and you download an APK and then you try to install it, it will say, oh, you have this setting disabled. Would you like to enable it for this one time only?
Perfect.
You can go into settings, uncheck or check that box, allow third-party downloads, sideloads. Well, and basically, that's the same thing as jailbreaking on an iPhone. And it carries the similar risks, which is instead of downloading it from the Google store, you're downloading from a non-Google store. And so there's some risk. Although there's lots of legitimate reasons for doing this. You've got one. So it just caution, that's all.
Yeah, and I would also argue that it's for the more sophisticated user who chafes at Apple's iOS curation model.
It's an option.
This lets, you know, it's like, hey, I want to own my phone and I want to put any software in it that I want to. So so I think this is
one of the reasons I like Android is because I can do this. But with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah. And this was thus my problem is, you know, that news organizations are irresponsibly telling people go get this now rather than waiting for the official release. And this on the back of stories that there have been infected instances of Pokemon Go. So yikes. I'm going to do deeper coverage of this also next week. I've already got it in next week's show notes because I want to understand what they've done. The first reporting that I saw provided no details. When I dug into it this morning, I found the white paper. And it's like, oh, now I have too many details. So researchers from the University of Florida and Villanova University claim to have found a, quote, obvious, unquote, solution to the encrypting malware problem, which they're dubbing Crypto Drop. They said, quoting from their paper, our system is more of an early warning system. It doesn't prevent the ransomware from starting. It prevents the ransomware from completing its task. So you lose only a couple of pictures or a couple of documents rather than everything that's on your hard drive. And it relieves you of the burden of having to pay the ransom. So that's why I need to look at this closer, because it's like, this sounds a little soft and a little heuristic and a little, how many files does it take before it notices it? Is it planting canaries through the file system that it's monitoring for change? You know, what's it doing? So I will, but it's certainly interesting. They gave a presentation last month at a security conference, so that seems to have some cred to it. It's in the show notes for next week. I will have a full report. And there is something available for Windows that grew out of this. I also saw. So again, I'll know more next week. I'll have read the white paper. And yes, Leo, the BBC described it as sounding like the Daleks. Of course, because of, you know, they're the BBC.
I know exactly what you're talking about. We talked about
the Doctor Who robots. Yeah. Yes. But it turns out it was researchers from UC Berkeley and Georgetown. They'd never expected this to be actually used. They were just curious whether it was possible. So that is, and that was what I was at the top of the show. I said from the, of course, someone had to try this department. So they asked the question, could we design some audio which we could sneak by people because it would just sound like something, but not what it is, which is audio commands a la the various voice command systems that we now have in the industry, which could, for example, convey an OK Google call 911 sort of command. And you know, I was put in mind of the famous work on the MP3 compression, which, as we know, the secret of that MP3 audio compression is, and it actually works in a similar way to JPEG, motion JPEG compression, is that you can't.
It's working. So if you didn't know what you were listening, they point out that you know what you're listening for. So you understand what it is. But if you just heard that kind of coming out of something like a toy.
Yeah, you'd think something was broken or like, right. You know, can you hear me now? You right. have to, you know, walk
right.
somewhere.
Right, but it works.
Yeah, so what these guys did, and they, yeah, and they made it work, and that, and so our listeners can have a sense for what it sounds like.
Yeah, and it worked. What it was saying was open XKCD, which is harmless, obviously, but it did. It opened it. Here's if you add background noise, even less distinctive. Here in a cafe. And then the second command.
Turn on airplane mode.
But you really, if you didn't know that was what was going on, you probably wouldn't detect it.
You're right. And so bottom line is they wanted to see whether they could do audio that was obfuscated essentially to people, but which the nature of the speech recognition algorithms that are in use would hear through. And what's the reason this is cool to me is that understanding someone saying commands in a noisy cafe, we humans take for granted our ability to an amazing degree find the signal in the noise.
Yeah.
But that is incredibly difficult for you know, software technology. Again, we just, our brains are phenomenally complicated. So yeah, our brains can do it. So in order to make speech recognition work in a practical way, it had to first ignore noise. It had to be able to do what we take for granted, which is separate the speech from the background. Mm. And so these guys realized that, or maybe were involved in solving that problem. And they said, okay, what if we add noise to the command? And so for the phone, that's what it's hearing all the time. It's hearing something that awful and managing to, because we take it for granted, but that's what the phone's hearing.
Right.
And we take it for granted. And so when something does that, the phone, it's like, oh yeah, I've had to be trained up, says the phone, in the ability to separate the voice from that background. These guys put background in on purpose, you know, added noise to it. And, you know, the phone does its job, what it was designed to do. The only something it had to be able to do. Cool. And we should take a break because...
Yeah, they got some miscellany coming up.
we have more to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And we will talk more, including Mr. Robot. But first, let me...
Mr. Robot.
But first, let me... Let me tell you a little bit about Braintree. Braintree is an awesome solution for any mobile app developer who wants to add payments. Now, I think if you listen to this show, you probably appreciate the difficulty in adding a payment solution. If you write your own, you're going to be up against, you know, some very challenging things. Not merely security, but reassuring your users that it's safe, that it's not Joe's payment solution, you know, that kind of thing. My suggestion is you probably shouldn't write it yourself. You probably should go to BraintreePayments.com/security now. These guys have a payment solution that's very easy for you to integrate. Just a few lines of code, works on Android, iOS, and JavaScript. You can even use it on web apps. And if there's any question in your mind as to whether this is a good way to go, well, let me tell you a few things that might help you understand it better. First of all, you can accept all kinds of payments, period. And when new ones come along, it's easy to add them. So, yeah, of course, credit cards and PayPal, but even Bitcoin and Android Pay and Apple Pay, all kinds of currencies from pounds to pesos. And it's got fraud protection, fast payouts for you. And you might also appreciate the fact that it is already used by some of the best in the business. For instance, you've used Braintree. You just may not know it. If you've ever used an Uber, that's how they work. If you've ever used Lyft, that's how they work. They use Braintree in their apps. If you've ever used those pinnable, buable pins that they do on Pinterest and around the web, that's Braintree too. That's their contextual payment system. If you've used Airbnb or Lyft or GitHub, you've used GitHub, surely. You've used Braintree. Simple, secure payments, code that's easy to integrate, the best in class, because the best in class use it, SDKs in .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby. It's easy. And your first $50,000 in payments will be fee-free. But you've got to go to BraintreePayments.com/security now. You do what you do best. Let them do what they do best. BraintreePayments.com/security now. We thank them for their support. They reached out to us because they knew that Steve has the high-tech audience listening, and they want to reach you developers. Yeah. Moving on.
So, miscellany time. I got a bunch of stuff to cover quickly. I just wanted to make sure everyone knows that Mr. Robot, Golden Globe winner for Best Drama after its first season last year, returns tomorrow, July 13th. And remember that there is the Hacking Robot post show, which will premiere immediately afterwards on USA Network.
Is that good? Is that worth watching?
I don't know. It's hosted by Andy Greenwald.
He's good.
Yeah. I know that I think they were doing the same thing with Breaking Bad, because it had such a
right. Oh, a lot of shows do it. There's the Walking Dead has the Talking Dead.
Oh,
it's
my
just
Lord.
Yeah, it's kind of the well, you know what was happening is blogs and magazines were stealing all of this. So they said, wait a minute, we got to put this on the show. On the network right after the show. We don't want to lose these viewers who want to talk obsessively.
Well, and Game of Thrones has it too, right?
Yep.
There's an After the Throne or Behind the Throne.
Exactly. Under the throne. They're not that. I mean, they're not great, but
yeah.
You know, there you go. Yeah.
So if you can't wait till tomorrow night, the first episode is floating around. It was teased and released a few days ago. Someone shot me the news, and I tweeted out that the reminder that the series was officially starting tomorrow. So I have heard good things about the first episode. A bunch. I can wait till Thursday. It'll record after I'm asleep on Wednesday night, and then I'll watch it on Thursday. Time shifting as I do, and that's fine. But I heard apparently it's off to a great a second season start. So the first episode apparently is immediately re-engaged people. So that's sounds great. And I picked up the news. I think it was Saturday.
The
new Screensavers pre-show. You mentioned you were moving to my non-Windows operating system.
Well,
FreeBSD.
So there's the one that focuses on security, which is OpenBSD, right? And then FreeBSD is the kind of the base that Open and NetBSD and PCBSD are
based on. So FreeBSD is faster than all of the others.
Right. It's the original too, kind of, you know.
Well, it is. And so what happens is, and it's not surprising, with any community of developers, especially, you're gonna have the community of egos. And, someone says, I want to do this. And they rest say, no, we're going to do that later. I want to do it now. And so, you know, I want to, you know, do something with networking. And they're like, no, well, that creates a fork. And so then you get NetBSD.
Right.
And then there, you know, an open BSD and so forth. So, yeah. So,
but you like free BSD.
It was recommended to me 15 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
By Brett Glass.
Well, there you go.
And I never regretted it. I've been running.
What do you use it on, though? I didn't realize were using it.
Oh, yes. I have three free BSD servers.
Ah.
That our DNS is running Bind 9, and the my good old GRC news groups, the NNTP server, that's okay. INN, and so that's one server, and then I just brought up another server for GRC's forthcoming forums, you know, standard web forums, because I need with the release of Squirrel, I have to have a readily accessible, high visibility public place for users and testers and developers to be able to collaborate. The NNTP news group is valuable for what it is, but it's just not accessible enough. And so that's where I was talking to you a couple of weeks ago of having brought up not quite a LAMP stack, but a FAMP stack.
Right.
Because
I
used FreeBSD at Apache and MariaDB, which is from the originators of MySQL, but they forked it back from Oracle because they don't trust Oracle in the long run. Or Larry, and then the PHP 7, and so that one's running FreeBSD 10.7, which is the current latest. And then the third one is also hosted on FreeBSD, and that's FreeNAS, is a FreeBSD based network attached storage system. So and of course I've got it. You can't see it on the shelf up there. There's something called Nano BSD. There's also Tiny BSD and Pico BSD. Nano BSD is the host for the pfSense router firewall
I've
been talking about.
Right.
So
I forgot you were doing all that. Yeah.
Yeah, and
where do you get your hardware for your FreeBSD? The reason I'm thinking of it, I mean, and there's use Linux is fine, use Windows OS 10 that's fine, but what I want is a rock solid. What I found is by using Linux, is I don't need Windows or OS 10. All the stuff I want to do, with the exception of Lightroom and their solutions around that, it can be done on an open source operating system. And then I started looking at stability, reliability, and the difference between Linux and BSD, which is kind of that BSD is a base unit that's all created at the same time, as opposed to Linux, which is a kernel and then stuff is added on top of it, and which makes BSD more reliable, I think.
What I like is that it is Unix.
It is true Unix. Right.
There is a UC Berkeley Regents of State of California because they had the source at one point.
Right.
I mean, there is that license in there. It is actual evolved Unix, as opposed to what Linus did, which was to create a Unix-like OS, you know, with
aiming toward POSIX compliance, as he says.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so I have, in what, 15 years, that it's never crashed.
Rebooted.
It's
never
hung. It's yeah, you
that's
don't
you want,
reboot.
15 year uptime.
It comes up and runs.
Yeah.
Now, I did hear you, and I sort of smiled at this, mentioning the difference between packages and ports.
Right.
And I was a ports user. I am now gleefully a packages user.
It's so much faster, of course.
That's my point.
Yeah.
And when you bring a system up, you get email from it at 3 a.m. every morning. And so, and what you see in the security report is, oh, these three packages, which are installed, have security vulnerabilities.
Right.
So you want to be able to go PKG space upgrade enter.
This is very much like the Unix, like the Linux experience, where you use apt-get or pacman, and it just and it updates because you've downloaded binaries, pre-compiled, ready to run binaries, much like you do on OS X. Very rarely, and Windows, very rarely do you download source code and build the application. And that's the port system. But the port system is so beautiful. I love the port system.
Well, and as I've said to you in the past, when you see this gibberish scrolling like endlessly,
makes you feel like you're doing something.
Where one character out of place and it wouldn't work. You're thinking, okay, this can't possibly work. You know, and I used to build the kernel. I rebuilt the kernel on our original server a couple of times, just tweaking it here and there, just because I wanted to play with that. And that's fun. But it's like, okay, I've done that now. I don't really need to. But so, for example, I have this older piece of hardware. It's an Intel system, SCSI. It's the SCSI 320 drives, an Adaptec 2120, I think it is, or 2021 RAID controller. I mean, it's just like this random machine, dual Xeon processors.
That's
so
what
it's
I was
nice.
Thinking of doing, yeah.
Yeah,
lots of RAM. BSD likes RAM. FreeBSD likes RAM.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm still running 4 gig on two of them, but for the FreeNAS, especially ZFS, really wants more
and
RAM.
That's what I'm really excited about is ZFS.
And so I just got 12 because this motherboard has six slots that can take 2 gigs per for RAM. So, I install, you know, FreeBSD from a CD, and it sees and recognizes everything in the system.
Yes,
you know, the older one, which is like 5 point something, it chokes a little bit when it's booting up on the RAID controller because it's like not happy with it. Well, they fixed that. Yes. And so 10 just cruises right through, recognizes everything. Everything came up and ran perfectly. And it's like, oh.
That was easy.
This is really nice.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
And so then I have, you know, I established asymmetric keys, so I'm able to SSH into it and just instantly get a command prompt with crypto keys, and it just makes administration and use a joy. So anyway,
I agree with you because I've been building from forts. I built Xorg and I built GNOME 3.
And I was
it took
thinking,
all
Leo,
day.
It's fun.
Even on a fast machine, it takes all day.
Fun to do it a few times, but then it's like, no, thank you.
Yeah. And there's some arguments for building from source because it's a little more customized to what you have than if you use a binary.
Actually, binary. The GRC's INN is customized.
Right.
There's all kinds of things I did. For example, when for a while we were having leakage from the news group out to Google or out to universities, it turns out they were reaching in and pulling news from us. And the people in the group said, you know, that seems wrong. We want to keep this here. And the other problem was people might be responding to posts that somebody had exfiltrated from our server, and you know, no one was ever going to see their response.
Right.
So it would be frustrating for them too. So, for example, one of the modifications I make tags the IP of the person who pulls the article in the article headers. It adds it to the article on the fly on the way out. So what's cool about that is that there's no information disclosure because everybody then is, if they look at their headers, they see their own IP. So, okay, that's no information was disclosed. But if an article appears out in the wild, we look at its headers and we get the IP of the entity that pulled it originally from us. And I think it's called X Original Reader is the header that I created. And so it allows us to backtrack and find out how things are escaping. And then I just go block them so that they can't have any more newsfeed. So, and there's a bunch of other things. Only people who post are able to delete their own postings. Nobody can delete anybody else's. So there's a whole curation system that I added to it. And this is all in C, but I was able to do it thanks to the open source,
right,
that I was able to bring the source down, figure out how it all worked, and then add some of my own code and recompile a custom version.
That's why I love open source. Yeah.
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 You know, and you're right, Leo. It's where I will end up.
You will end up. Well, you're already there. I keep forgetting that you're running all these free BSD boxes. Do you build them? Just put them together yourself, or do you have
Yeah.
That's my real concern. What I want to do is replace my computer at home, my iMac at home. But it's I want a 3-monitor solution, and I want to make sure it's all going to work. And so that's the challenge. And of course,
The coolest thing is that people are used to having, like with Windows, where we keep chasing Microsoft's eternal quest for more power, we chase it up to the point now where we have water-cooled chips, you know, in order to display a Pokemon running around the screen. It's like, what has happened? So what I wanted to tell our listeners is, anyone listening to this podcast has a machine in the closet that's like, I mean, an old machine. They didn't want to part with it.
Older's better, frankly.
That's my point, is that FreeBSD allows a machine like that to have an entire next life, essentially. Right. Put a couple, if you want to play with pfSense, put a couple of cheap network adapters in, or get a quad NIC, stick it in, FreeBSD will see it, recognize it, know what it is, and then you just download the free pfSense and you have a world-class firewall router for zero cost that you can play with.
I'm looking forward to it.
Neat. Congrats. Yep. I think it's the right place.
It's definitely the right thing. And of the stuff I do at home, the one thing is photography is the only one, is Lightroom and photography. And there are easy ways around that, including I still have a lot of Macs.
It's funny. I heard you mention that also before. And I was put in mind of the beginning of Windows when I was still in DOS. DOS worked. Brief worked. You know, WordStar worked. Everything was fine. But then there was this micrographics designer. It was like, oh gosh, look at those! Look at that. And so I would fire Windows up only to run that one program, which was one of the early graphics design tools under Windows. Well, and I would do something and then come back to DOS.
That's one of the solutions, is running Wine and just for Lightroom. It works fine. Yeah. Works fine. And for the kinds of stuff, my hobby stuff, the programming stuff I do, this is the way to go.
Oh, Leo, you just look through
all the tools. The tooling is so much better. Yeah.
It really is what's Paul's word? An enthusiast's.
It's an enthusiast.
A computing enthusiast's platform.
There's a, for Python, for instance, you want to learn Python or use Python in your future life as a retired reformed Windows user. There's some really interesting Python. There's like bpython, which lets you use a command, a REPL to type in stuff. And if you like it, save it to paste bin so that you can kind of code in this interesting way where you're trying stuff, seeing what happens, and then saying, yeah, keep that. And it's very interactive. It's very interesting. And all of these tools are they're free, widely available, and best yet, very well supported. I mean, lots of enthusiasts out there. That's why I like Linux, too. Arch Linux has an amazing wiki.
I'm not an expert in Unix, so as I'm putting together this new system, I would hit a little roadblock, and I go,
somewhere
and
online.
And I just Google a phrase, and okay, fine, I just press that button, and off I go again. Speaking of pfSense, for those who may be running it, it just received a very nice facelift. I didn't otherwise know about it, and I went to the main system page, and I got there's a little flashing notice there saying upgrade available. And I thought, and I had time. So, and it upgrades itself in place. So I just clicked the button, and it downloaded into its other image bank an update. It's supposed to restart itself, and it didn't. It may have been because it was a major change. Once I got that, then there was a .1 update to that one, and that one did restart and come back up. For the major jump, it went down, and I expected it to, but then I kind of okay, how long should this be taking? And I waited for a while, and then I pulled the power and plugged it back in again, and then it came up. So it just had a little bit of a catch. But the new UI is way more mature, a little flatter look, like, you know, is modern now. And some they spent a lot of time on it. So I just want to let people know, because you wouldn't maybe otherwise know that there was a new version. I'm on all kinds of mailing lists and things, but no one told me. So it did.
Yeah.
And so I did, and I wanted to acknowledge everybody who sent me the link to the Apollo assembly language source code.
Isn't that fun?
Fun to look through. And as you said when you were talking about it over the weekend, Leo, and you're right. Well, it's for some random homegrown obscure yeah. computer. So yeah. it's not like you can run this
on
anything.
You can't assemble it and run it. Yeah.
Although there is an emulator.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
I mean, if you're like really want to burn your engines, then you
can. It'd be fun, wouldn't it?
You can stir the gas or stir the hydrogen or whatever
and
it was.
There's the fireworks display, which is fun. It's really fun just to look at it and just feel the history. Just pour through it. It's amazing. Yeah.
And I'm tempted to rename Peter Hamilton's novel, which he called The Great North Road, The Endless North Road.
Yeah, it's kind of long. I know.
Oh.
I know.
However, I'm at the end.
Did you finish it?
I think I'm it feels like I'm at the I think I finished the penultimate chapter.
Yes. There you go.
I concluded.
You can tell it's kind of wrapping up. They've solved the mystery.
Yes. Yeah. Nothing. It was. And so.
By the way, not the best solution either. I mean, it's kind of a little bit of it.
I love his work. There was lots of clever stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is his best work.
I agree.
I think Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. Of that pair. I like the Aussie world and all that, but I was tweeting a little bit with someone who just finished the Roe Agenda prequel trilogy about Jack and Janet, the CIA assassin people, and he really enjoyed those. And so we were talking a little bit about. You know, because I was here, I was in not quite where I am now. I feel a sense of relief now. It's like, okay, that's over. And it's his point was, and remember when I sort of a little snarky towards Richard Phillips' work, that is the Roe Agenda guy, and then I backed off on that. I was apologized because it was wrong. It's that Richard's stuff doesn't have fluff, and Peter's adds decoration. And sparkles to the fluff. Yeah. I mean, oh my Lord. You know, I know what color socks their various people are wearing and whether they like stripes or checks. And it's like, okay, this is really important. But on the other hand, you end up really knowing these people rather deeply at quite some expense. So it was great. I'm glad I read it, but it was a long read. But again, some interesting new concepts, but I don't know. Seemed a little bit lighter than usual for him. And, you know, the one that we're now waiting for, due in September, the sequel to the whatever it is, Abyss of Dreams, Beyond the Dreams, or whatever.
The Faller Chronicle. Yeah.
Probably the fun again.
I finished that one. That's awesome.
So, and I did get a nice note from a listener who asked me to please share this. His name is Dave Jones. This actually came as a DM. Rather lengthy DM. He said, "Hi, Steve. I wanted to drop you a quick message to add yet another success story to your ever-growing pile of SpinRite testimonials. I'm a software engineer living in Edinburgh, Scotland, though I'm originally from England, where my folks still live. As I suspect will be the case for many of your listeners, I provide tech support for my friends and family. On my latest visit to my parents, my dad asked me to look at his Windows 7 laptop that, over the previous months, had slowly ground to a crashing, unresponsive halt. Over the course of a few hours, I followed your advice." Oh, this is the guy I was talking about earlier. I knew I'd heard it recently. I followed your advice to upgrade Windows Update, install Never 10, and replace third-party AV with Microsoft Windows Defender. All of this knowledge accumulated over many years listening to Security Now, a valuable resource not only for security, but also for staying abreast of Windows issues, not easy when you develop exclusively in OS X. After auditing the laptop's software, I pulled out my copy of SpinRite and set it running at level 4, which is the deep one, on the laptop's hard drive. So he wanted to give it a good scrubbing. SpinRite ran for almost exactly 24 hours. And though the status screen reported no faulty sectors, as we know it often will, I rebooted the system, feeling quietly optimistic. Sure enough, SpinRite had forced the hard drive to take a long, hard look at itself, and the laptop is now running like a dream. Thank you for your brilliant suite of tools, library of podcasts, and methodical approach to problem solving. Give my regards to Leo and his wonderful podcast network. I'll visit that studio someday. Kind regards, Dave Jones.
Thank you, Dave.
And he said, P.S., please feel free to share this on a future SN podcast. In fact, I'd love it if you did.
Well, there you go. You got your wish. All right, we've got some questions, and we'll get to them in one moment. First, I want to talk a little bit about Adobe and marketing. If you are in business for yourself, or you're in a marketing department, or you're the marketing guy or gal, you know that keeping up with this industry is really challenging. It's moving very quickly. The internet has changed everything, and knowing how to kind of navigate digital waters is crucial to your marketing strategy. Adobe has put together some white papers that are very interesting, very informative, and now easy to digest because they've put them out on audio. It's kind of a podcast on iTunes. You can find it on iTunes. Just search for audio white papers for marketing. And I think you're going to really love these if you want to keep up to date on the latest marketing trends and technologies, things like learning the differences between interaction metrics, engagement metrics, and value metrics so you can figure out what part of your creative is working best, creating personalized content that's relevant to consumers using predictive analytics. I don't even know what I'm talking about at this point. Creating a 360-degree view of each customer, no matter where they are interacting with your brand. The key is there's a lot going on in this business. It's changing rapidly, but Adobe can help you keep up. These are free. They're well-read. I'll play just a little bit of it so you can hear. And you can find them on iTunes.
Adobe presents the new content frontier. Your customers have grown accustomed to having massive amounts of content
Audible's
at their fingertips.
Best readers, by the
whether
way.
They get it on their laptops, tablets, or phones.
They spent some money getting somebody good to read these. I'm glad they did. You can read them, of course, but it's easiest to listen, like on the way in the car and so forth. Just search for audio white papers for marketing on iTunes or visit Adobe.com for more information. That's audio white papers for marketing. And we thank Adobe Marketing Cloud for their support of Security Now. Now, let me go and see what questions I have for you, Steve. You said these came from... Yeah, I see them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
mostly came from Twitter. We start off with Hans Decker, who asks, if I keep an internet exposed web server, for instance, or a Minecraft server, that's what I'm doing, on a Wi-Fi guest network with limited access, am I safe? At Hans Decker.
So I'm a little confused, I guess, by Wi-Fi guest network. So the server maybe has a wireless access point, and then it links to a wireless router. I guess I'm more used to seeing a machine like that, an internet exposed web server, would be plugged into a router. So I wasn't exactly sure what Hans meant.
I think that's what he means. He says, what he wants to do. I understand what he wants to do, because in my server, which is running on a Mac Pro, my Minecraft server, SSH server, wiki web server, is plugged in. But it has Wi-Fi. Well, so what if and what he wants to do is isolate it, right?
Right. And so
you have to DMZ it, or you have to port forward somehow. You have to indicate that traffic coming in on 35565 is going to go to that server. Well, what if you put it on a guest Wi-Fi? Would that protect the rest of the network from it?
The problem is there are too many unknowns to in order to suggest that would actually provide protection. What I was put in mind of was what I did when I brought up this forthcoming forum server, because as we know, we've covered that for years. Traditionally, forum software, especially a SQL back end, is like one of the worst places from a security standpoint. So there was no way I would even consider bringing up a system where anonymous people could post their own content into a server unless I could absolutely isolate it from the rest of GRC.
That's what he's asking.
Yes. And so this brings up two things. What I did was what I needed was to know that no matter what could possibly happen on that server, no matter what could crawl inside it from the outside through an unknown problem in the forum software, or for example, if there was a Minecraft server, some buffer overflow that might exist there. Yeah. No matter what could happen, no meltdown or compromise of that machine could in any way affect the rest of GRC's network. That, again, I'd just rather not have it than to have something that is a source of that kind of vulnerability. So I used to have the hub of that links all these different machines together was a very nice gigabit switch. It is now a managed switch. And that's not something we've ever spoken about before. A managed switch is very much like a multi-port appliance that you plug things into. And if you don't explicitly configure it, it acts just like an unmanaged switch. That is to say, the hubs / switches that we're used to talking about, they are implicitly unmanaged, meaning there's nothing to manage. There's nothing to do. But managed switches give you a console interface, or more recently, a web interface. And what I chose was a product from Cisco. I liked that it had my initials. It was the SG300-10, which is a cute little 10-port, thus the -10, 10-port managed switch. Basically, it is the sort of the OS side of Cisco's iOS, the Internet Operating System, and you're able to define access control lists, ACLs. So essentially, it is an inexpensive hardware firewall. And again, when I say hardware, when we talked about this question last week, what's the difference between a hardware and a software firewall? It's like, well, yes, it's running an operating system. It's the software in there. But by hardware, I mean, that's all it is. So now, rather than having all of the servers at GRC converge on this switch where they're able to share traffic among themselves, on a port-by-port basis, I'm able to impose rules on which packet traffic is allowed to ingress and egress from each port individually. So, for example, the port that this forums server is already running on, it is able to send email, because I have to be able to do that from the forum software. It can access GRC's SMTP server, which is on a different piece of machine, and that's it. It is blacked out from the rest of the network. I make it go get DNS from outside. It talks to the rest of free BSD land from outside. So it is in my network, but it is absolutely bolted down so that it has no matter what happens in there, it can't get up to any other kind of mischief. So one option is to add to an existing network a managed switch. And you'll want to make sure if this is the kind of thing you want to do, because there are grades of management. You probably want what's known as a layer 3 as opposed to a layer 2 managed switch, because layer 2 can do things like quality of service and traffic prioritization, but not packet filtering. You want to make sure that the one you get can do access control lists, packet filtering. Dell makes them. You know, Amazon has a bunch of them, and they're not super cheap. They're a few hundred dollars. But the alternative, and this is the second part of this, is, for example, this little pfSense box I have it's got 4 network interface adapters. So any little machine with multiple NICs, the concept here is that you want port isolation, so that the computer is plugged into a physical port, and there are then firewall rules, and we call them firewall just because it's looking at the packet and deciding what to permit or to drop. There are rules that say, you know, only this traffic is able to come in or out. And so, for example, in the case of this forum server, it has full access to the internet for all the things it wants to do, only to GRC's SMTP server that feels unlikely that it's able to get up to any kind of mischief. If I weren't so careful, then I might put firewall rules in that machine. But of course, we can't trust firewall rules in that machine because it's the machine that might be compromised. So the solution has to be outboard. And we never really talked much about actually bringing up packet filtering to our audience. But I have a feeling we're going to be headed in that direction in the future, because this Internet of Things and doing more sophisticated things like running a publicly facing server in your home, where you want to make sure that there isn't a crossover between any mischief it gets up to and the rest of your home network. The way to do that is isolating the traffic. And I know people will talk about VLANs, and that's sort of a mistake. Virtual LAN technology is an organizational tool, not a security tool. It can be used for security, but you have to be very careful that the switches that you use honor the VLAN tagging and that's all done really right. I regard it as a fragile solution. So I think physical port isolation is the way to go. And so it's either a multi-port router where you have control over individual traffic coming in and out of the switch on an interface by interface basis. And for example, pfSense gives you all that. It's a full firewall also. Or another solution is, and I expect we're going to see some downward pressure on pricing, because I would like them to be cheaper for our listeners, is a managed switch that can do layer 3 management. They're just, it's so fun to play with. Oh, and you can do other cool things like port mirroring. You're able to, for example, tell a managed switch that you want all of the traffic on the following ports to also be forwarded out of that port. And of course, that's where you put your monitor in order to like watch what's going on your network. So it's able to see all of the traffic coming
and
going.
They're not so horribly expensive. Here's one from HP that's $160.
Wow, that looks nice. How many ports does that have? That has like
24
like
ports. I mean, you don't need that many, but
you won't run out.
You won't run out. So as effectively,
yeah,
you could
think
of this.
That's a good price.
I should just buy this and put my server. Now, the way I've done it is it turns out I have two Comcast networks. So I use one for the server and just my office stuff. And then the house, the whole house network is on the Comcast business class and is separate. No, it's vice versa, actually. I'm on the Comcast business class because that way I have a static IP address.
Well, Leo, as I expected, we have filled our time.
Oh, that's right. And we haven't filled our question quota.
No, but let's punt those to next week. We already have some topics to discuss, following up in more depth on some of the stuff from this week. And so to be continued.
Good. HP has an 8-port level 3 switch for only $83. That's probably enough for
Wow.
me.
Wow. I got it. Okay. Where is that?
It's on Amazon right now. It's a Prime, baby. Prime. You buy one and I'll buy one.
HP 8-port manage.
It's, yeah. 8-port. And it's level 3, right? L3, right? That's what you need.
Layer 3. 8377.
Yeah. And 8 ports is enough. I'm not running more than 8 servers. So what you would do is that you could still put this on your network and use it as a buffer, as an isolator. Is that the idea?
Okay, now I'm not seeing it says layer 3. So it says single IP management. So that's for managing traffic prioritization, rate limiting, broadcast control, secure web GUI, session logging, flash images, port mirroring. It has all that, but I'm not seeing packet filtering. So that's the one thing.
Okay.
That's the thing we absolutely want to make sure we're getting. And the way I was solving this question was just, you know, going and finding, you know, go to HP, pull down the PDF docs and see if it's got web, you know, if it's got packet filtering as an option in there.
Because essentially that's what you're using to isolate it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. You are, and I mean, and our listeners will have so much fun with this because you're creating rules that say traffic bound for this range of IPs on this protocol at this port allow, and then otherwise if it's, and so it's sort of like a stepwise, very much like a little computer program where each rule is examined for allow or deny until it matches the characteristics of the packet. And then normally by default, there's a deny any, meaning if it didn't match, if there wasn't an explicit allow any as the last rule, then when it falls off the end, it drops the packet. So this gives you absolute control over managing, you know, who's able to do what on your system. And if we can find one that's inexpensive and we know does packet filtering, then that would be a win because I would give our listeners something really, it's just so fun to play with.
Well, those rules sound familiar. They sound like firewall rules. So it sounds like it's very similar to that kind of.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, I guess, you know, I would call, when you say, okay, what is a firewall? Well, it's something that restricts some traffic.
Right.
And so that's what this is. It, you know, technically it's called an access control list, meaning, you know, an ACL. It is a list that specifies the type of, the families or classes or types of traffic that is allowed in and out of a port on a port-by-port basis.
I would bet this doesn't do that packet filtering and that you'd have to get the enterprise version to do that. That'd be my guess.
Oh, but here's the one that does. Right in the little chart down below, the SG310, the one I got.
Oh.
That's $175.
Well,
so okay,
not
it's
terribly expensive.
It's less expensive than I remembered. So yeah, that one, it's running a version of iOS, the famous Cisco Internet Operating System that the routers run. Very nice web interfaces, 10 ports. And again, it's not 24, but come on, 10, you know. And so, I mean, most of your stuff is all going to be on one switch feeding into that
right.
for for management in the aggregate. But that's the one I bought, this little SG300-10. It comes with little wings, so you can 19-inch rack mount it. It's sitting in at level three in the data center, rack mounted right now. That's the one I'm using.
I'm going to cancel that other one, and I'm going to get the SG.
The SG, the Steve Gibson 300.
Steve Gibson approved model. Nice. Folks, that concludes this edition of Security Now. We're getting ready for TNT, so we better wrap it up here. I see Jason Howell has arrived. Don't forget, you can get this show on Steve's website, along with SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, and all the great free stuff he does. GRC.com. We have also the show in audio and video at our website, twit.tv/SN. And the best way to do it is subscribe. Somebody asked me on Twitter, well, I missed a few episodes, and your feed only has 10. What do I do? Well, feeds, that's the nature of feeds. 10 was like generous. It's the most recent shows. But you go to the website, twit.tv/SN. Every show ever is there. And then I also pointed them to my blog, leolaporte.com, where we have user-submitted scripts for downloading
range. Subscribing prevent you from missing them? You don't have to go get them
right.
One by one.
You just subscribe. And that way you'll get everything going forward. You'll always have it. Exactly.
Right.
Unless you have some rule. Sometimes some of the podcasters have rules like if I don't listen to it in a month, can delete it and stuff like that. Cool. We'll be back here every Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. So stop by, say hi, join us in the chat room, and we'll see you next time on Security.
We already have a great show lined up for next week.
We're planned.
So.
We're all ready. We're ready to go.
Just pause your life for however many hours that is.
We'll be back soon. Take care.
Bye. Security Now.